Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open with highlights from a county supervisor's hearing on adopting a community choice energy program for San Diego's unincorporated areas, including what that means for residents who will now have a choice other than SDG&E to get power, how your representatives voted, and some local reactions. High fire danger has led to shutdown of Cleveland National Forest until mid-September. And after a heated hearing, a divided board of supervisors voted to declare medical misinformation a public health crisis and create plans to address it. Get details on today's show. From Public News Service, hear why wildfires across California are impacting air quality, including indoors. And then on Crime Beat, we'll have a report on frightening freeway shootings on Highways 94 and 805, and the shooter is still at large. A viral video at Valhalla High School in El Cajon showed a staffer pressing his knee to the neck of a black female student to break up a fight. It's drawn outrage and calls for reform from leaders in the black community, while the district pledges a transparent investigation. From California News Service, we'll have a report on efforts in Congress to reform federal student loan repayment requirements. There's a new earthquake early warning app, and we'll tell you how to get it on today's show. Some rescued bear cubs are now at the county's wildlife rehab center in Ramona after losing their mother and having some close encounters with residents elsewhere in California. Then from Public News Service, we'll have some National Labor Day news, including the latest report on jobs and more. Next, hear why California is facing a critical nursing shortage. And then we'll have a special report on county supervisors' hearing on public safety power shutoffs due to high fire risk conditions and what mitigation measures the county is taking to help protect the safety of residents during those outages. With wildfires burning across the state, we'll also have some fire prevention tips for you later on today. And finally, we'll be re-airing one of our oldies but goodies on our Wildest Jobs segment, our interview with Lakeside's rodeo clown, talking about his unusual occupation. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
By a 3-2 vote, San Diego County Supervisors have approved joining San Diego Community Power, a Community Choice Energy Program, or CCE. East County's two representatives, Supervisors Joel Anderson and Jim Desmond, both voted no, but for different reasons. Residents in unincorporated areas of the county are expected to start receiving power from clean energy sources through the CCE starting in spring 2023, although residents can opt out if they prefer to stay with SDG&E. SDG&E will still provide transmission lines and delivery, as well as billing. The San Diego Community Power currently is charging about 1-2% less for electricity than SDG&E. Now, as background, in October 2019, supervisors voted to establish a CCE program for the unincorporated areas with a goal of 90% of energy coming from renewables by 2030. In April of this year, the board asked staff to research options. Staff prepared a feasibility study and held 5 public workshops. At the August 31st hearing, supervisors were presented by staff with 2 CCEs as options. The first, San Diego Community Power, includes the cities of San Diego, La Mesa, Chula Vista, Imperial Beach, and Encinitas. The second option, Clean Energy Alliance, which is larger, includes Carlsbad, Del Mar, and Solana Beach. Staff did not recommend one over the other, noting that both were financially sound. Chairman Nathan Fletcher summed up his support following testimony, then made a motion to join San Diego Community Power as the CCE, and to name Supervisor Tara Lawson Reamer to represent the county on the CCE's board, with Supervisor Nora Vargas as alternate.
So I think today is a historic day for our county to finally move forward on doing this. It's good for our environment, it's good for our economy, it's good for our residents to give them choice. So I want to make a motion to approve joining San Diego community power, and I would like to suggest nominating Supervisor Lawson Reamer to serve as a board member and Vice Chair Vargas to serve as an alternate.
But Supervisor Joel Anderson, whose district is 40% unincorporated areas, including large swaths of rural East County, objected to unincorporated areas not having any representation on the board, calling this a disservice. The major industrial-scale wind and solar projects built or proposed are, after all, predominantly in unincorporated communities in East County, not urban or coastal areas, and inland residents often face high utility bills with hotter summers and colder winters than coastal areas. Anderson motioned for East County to be represented on the CCE's board, specifically the vast unincorporated areas represented by himself and by Supervisor Desmond, drawing applause from some in the crowd.
My concern is the board member wants the citizens of the unincorporated area to be represented. And, you know, while they both have some in their district, this should be set in stone moving forward that it has to come from these districts.
But Chairman Fletcher quashed that motion, stating it was important to have representatives committed to the CCE succeeding, and noted that both Anderson and Desmond did previously voice concerns. Fletcher said representation can be reconsidered in January. Supervisor Desmond said he would prefer the second option, Clean Energy Alliance, because it is smaller.
I can see the writing on the wall, but I do think the Clean Energy Alliance option would be a better option. We'd be the big fish in the tank as opposed to the second largest fish. And plus, we're, you know, by joining with San Diego, we're making one huge conglomerate. We're just going to be a mini SDG&E.
The action drew reactions from East County residents ranging from praise to criticism. Susan Brinkman, a Santee resident, posted on East County Magazine's Facebook page, "I love the idea and have been encouraging the County Board of Supervisors to adopt this policy for several years now. We do not need a monopoly when it comes to our utilities. Very glad this is happening, finally." However, Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, has a different view. She's the founder of the nonprofit Backcountry Against Dumps, which has led battles to fight against industrial-scale wind and solar projects close to rural homes and on scenic public lands. She calls the action disheartening, noting that San Diego Community Power recently approved a power purchase agreement for a controversial massive solar project in Hucumba before the environmental review was even completed. Tisdale told East County Magazine in an email after the vote that San Diego Community Power's representatives, quote, have no clue how much they are unnecessarily industrializing this backcountry, nor do they appear to care. She noted that none of the supervisors, even Anderson, who represents rural East County, voiced concern over other major projects such as Boulder Brush Substation tied to an expansion of Campo Wind, even after many residents and tribal members spoke in opposition. With several backcountry wind and solar projects still pending in the backcountry, Tisdale fears more of the same disproportionate adverse events to, quote, our predominantly low-income rural communities and tribal lands to provide power to more heavily populated coastal and urban areas. She wants to see the new CCE invest in energy production closer to urban and suburban areas where power is used, such as rooftop solar, and to avoid reliance on importing energy through vulnerable transmission lines that do run through the most fire-prone areas of the county. However, Matthew Vasilikas, policy co-director of Climate Action Campaign, voiced the view of many who testified in support of the new CCE. He called the action necessary, quote, to save the people and places we love from the climate crisis. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Cleveland National Forest is shut down until September 17th due to fire danger, along with federal forests statewide. The aim is to protect the safety of firefighters and the public during high fire danger conditions, with wildfires raging across much of the state. Here in San Diego County, the closures include popular hiking trails such as Cedar Creek Falls and Three Sisters Falls, as well as the Hauser and Pine Creek Wilderness areas and more. The closure was announced just before Labor Day weekend, regional forester Jennifer Everly says, "We do not take the decision lightly, but this is the best choice for public safety." According to U.S. Forest Service press release, several factors led to this decision, including helping prevent visitors from becoming entrapped, decreasing the risk of new fires starting at a time of limited firefighting resources and strained hospital resources, and the potential of extreme fire conditions. Federal forest lands in California currently have record-level fuel and fire conditions, with fire behavior beyond normal past experiences, including fire tornadoes and wildfires that spread quickly overnight. More than 6,800 wildfires have burned 1.7 million acres across all jurisdictions in California so far this year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
After more than 14 hours of contentious testimony, county supervisors voted 3-2 on August 31st to declare medical misinformation a public health crisis in the San Diego region. The prescribed cure? A directive for the county's chief administrative officer to implement recommendations of the U.S. Surgeon General to identify and label health misinformation, along with strategies to expand outreach in partnership with medical and community partners to provide facts about COVID-19. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy praised San Diego's first-in-the-nation action on her Twitter feed, stating, "It's the kind of bold action we need to ensure we all have accurate, science-based information to inform our health." Within days, the State Assembly followed the county's lead, passing a resolution declaring medical misinformation a statewide public health crisis. That resolution was introduced by Assemblywoman Akilah Weber, a medical doctor and Democrat representing portions of San Diego and East County. Now, the county measure drew both strong opposition and support in that 14-hour hearing. Supervisors Jim Desmond and Joel Anderson, both Republicans, voted against it, while Democrats Nora Vargas, Tara Lawson-Reamer, and Chair Nathan Fletcher voted in favor. Desmond told KUSI that over 400 people voiced opposition. He said, "Misinformation, I agree, is dangerous. However, it is hard for me to believe that we or anyone we know knows everything about medicine. Today's facts may be tomorrow's misinformation," he said. Some have voiced concerns that the measure might stifle free speech, although it does not prohibit anyone from speaking their views. It does, however, create a framework to combat statements that public health officials deem misleading. But others contend that false or misleading information is actually harming patients' health and dissuading some from getting vaccinated or accepting medically proven treatments that can help them, instead of ingesting large doses of ivermectin, a horse deworming drug, for example, that can cause serious damage to the intestinal tract or even death. Chairman Fletcher said medical misinformation is prolonging the COVID-19 pandemic nationally and it requires all of us coming together to slow the spread of misinformation. Those speaking in favor also included representatives from local hospitals and medical centers who testified that hospital resources are overwhelmed by a flood of unvaccinated COVID-19 patients. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
With major wildfires burning across California, including the destructive Dixie Fire, the worst in the state's history, California News Service has a special report about how wildfire smoke is increasingly impacting indoor air quality and what can be done about it.
Smoke from the massive wildfires, along with the summer heat, is driving millions of Californians indoors, so experts are advising people to pay attention to their indoor air quality. The idea is to avoid anything that burns, but particularly gas stoves. Dr. Lisa Patel with Stanford University says gas stoves give off nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide, and microscopic irritants called particulate matter.
We can inhale them, they enter our lungs and into our bodies and set off inflammation that can cause things like heart attack, stroke, respiratory infections, or asthma.
Patel says on poor air quality days when people can't open their windows, they should cook with the microwave or an electric appliance such as a griddle, crock pot, or rice cooker. If you must turn on the burner, be sure to also turn on your range hood and consider using an air purifier. Gas dryers, furnaces, and water heaters, which vent to the outdoors, also burn methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Barbara Gottlieb is director for environment and health with the nonprofit Physicians for Social Responsibility. She says the state needs to move toward homes and buildings that run entirely on electricity derived from clean energy and stop burning natural gas.
Its power in terms of trapping heat in the atmosphere is more than 80 times that of carbon dioxide over a short time frame. So for the sake of climate, you want to reduce your use of methane in every way that you can.
Patel predicts that wildfires, made worse by climate change, will soon become a year-round problem in California. The latest report from the International Panel on Climate Change found that the past 5 years have been the hottest on record since 1850. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Mitchell Murphy with the Crime Beat Report. The California Highway Patrol is seeking witnesses to 2 freeway shootings on August 31st by a shooter who remains at large. Both victims described the suspect vehicle as a black 4-door sedan, and one described it as similar to a Nissan Altima or Maxima. The shootings injured 2 motorists. The first shooting occurred around 2:14 a.m. on northbound Interstate 805 and Imperial Avenue. The second happened 11 minutes later on eastbound State Route 94, just east of College Grove Way near Lemon Grove. The victims of both incidents were transported to local hospitals for treatment of their injuries and are expected to recover. Anyone with information or may have witnessed either of the shootings is asked to contact the California Highway Patrol.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education report. A campus supervisor at Valhalla High School in El Cajon has been put on paid administrative leave after a video went viral showing him pressing a knee on the neck of an African-American female student. The controversial restraint tactic was used in an effort to break up a fight between 2 students on August 31st. There are several videos shot from different angles. The 53-second video that went viral shows 2 African-American girls fighting. A white supervisor pushed both students to the ground. A staffer grabbed one of the girls, who stood and appeared to stop her aggressive actions. The campus supervisor then pressed his knee against the neck of the other girl while she was on the ground. The Grossmont Union High School District released a statement indicating an investigation is underway and that the employee has been placed on paid administrative leave after that viral video. The statement reads, "Anytime allegations of employee misconduct are brought forward, the district takes those allegations very seriously," adding, "In the event of actual misconduct, the district takes appropriate disciplinary action up to and including dismissal." District Superintendent Teresa Kemper shared a video of her own in which she promised transparency.
"I'm here to let you know that the district is working with the Valhalla administration to investigate the incident, and whatever the results are, we will respond appropriately. As the investigation proceeds, you have my commitment that our district staff and our Valhalla team, led by Principal Brianne Frumas, will be as open as we possibly can about the situation. While it's important to understand we won't be able to comment on specifics of an ongoing investigation, please know that we will be transparent with any information we are able to share with you. Some students and staff are still feeling the effects of what happened on Tuesday. In light of the events that have taken place in America over the last 2 years, it's completely understandable that students and members of our school community are upset. We at the district are making sure Principal Frumas has all the resources she needs."
Kemper also said that counseling services are available on campus along with tools to provide healing. The Grossmont District also includes Helix Charter High School in La Mesa, where a 2018 incident in which a La Mesa Police School Resource Officer knocked a handcuffed black female student to the ground also went viral, sparking calls for reform. But La Mesa Police found the officer did not violate any department protocols, and that officer remains on the force, although not as a school resource officer.
Leaders in San Diego County's African American community are speaking out, voicing anger and concern over the Valhalla incident, which some say is part of a long and troubling pattern. Reverend Shane Harris, president of the People's Alliance for Justice Advocates, calls the incident concerning and inappropriate. On Facebook, he says, the school official is visibly larger than the girl, and the force used seems to appear excessive by someone who isn't even a police officer. In a prepared statement, Harris indicated he's meeting with the two students and their guardian, working toward next steps to assure justice and restoration. Both students are foster youths, says Harris, a former foster youth himself, who says he knows all too well how an incident like this can impact the trauma of a child in the foster care system. The NAACP's San Diego chapter has issued a statement calling for the campus supervisor to be fired. The NAACP statement reads, "Have we as a society learned nothing about excessive force? Are we still, after all this time, willing to allow reckless and dangerous amounts of force to be used by peace officers? Are we really okay with this level of force being used against children?" Francine Maxwell, who heads the local branch of the NAACP, told 10 News that she's seen several videos of the incident, which she calls excessive force. Maxwell said, "I viewed that there was more than 30 seconds with the knee being placed on a young African American's neck." Adding, "After the murder of Mr. George Floyd, people were supposed to go through de-escalation techniques. There are other tools that don't have to resemble the carotid restraint." According to Maxwell, the school supervisor is a retired sheriff's officer, making his use of force against a black student even more disturbing in her view. Also troubling is that the 14-year-old student subjected to the knee on her neck did not start the altercation, which was initiated by the other girl, according to Maxwell. She questions why the staffer used a tactic, quote, "we know to be lethal," unquote, on a girl who weighs just 105 pounds and was not armed, and nor was the other girl. She says no action was taken after earlier complaints by the NAACP, including a blackface incident on campus or a staffer who reportedly used the N-word. Maxwell says it is long past time for things to be done. And she added pointedly at a 10 News interview, "When school districts like Grossmont or San Diego Unified aren't willing to clean houses themselves, there are avenues at the state and federal level to force them to do so. We will be pursuing those." Kevin LaChapelle, a former El Cajon police officer and author of a book on police misconduct, notes that the leg is the strongest part of the human body. He told 10 News, "To have that pressure on the neck can cause some serious issues." Neither the district nor the student's family have announced as of our show taping deadline whether she suffered any physical injuries, but some have voiced concerns over mental or emotional trauma. Kenya Taylor, a former supervisorial candidate and mental health expert, is a Valhalla graduate with two children who also attended the school with challenges, according to her post on Facebook. "It's worse now," she adds, saying she didn't sleep well after seeing video of the Valhalla use of force against the 14-year-old student. Taylor concludes, "I can't imagine the pain the student is going through."
In January, student loan borrowers will have to start paying off their loans again as the pandemic-related pause on payment is set to expire. Now, a new report looks at ways to fix problems in the student loan system. Report co-author Michelle Domino says the repayment programs are far too complex, especially for teachers, health workers, and social workers who apply for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
Right now, only about 1% of applicants who are submitting for public service loan forgiveness are actually seeing those applications approved.
The report also found that the income-driven repayment plan is reaching far too few people, and many borrowers become discouraged when their payments only cover the interest and not the principal on their loan. In the U.S., 45 million borrowers are struggling under $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. Domino says now is the time to consider proposals to cap interest on student loans, to limit interest to the amount required to service the loan, or to transition to upfront one-time fees instead of charging interest.
It's an opportunity in the lead-up to the lifting of the repayment freeze to really think about whether there are alternatives to interest, lower interest rates, grace periods with interest, or other policies that could help to ensure that borrowers are actually paying down the principal that they've taken on.
Starting in October, the U.S. Department of Education's new Committee on Student Loan Reform will tackle these issues in a monthly series of meetings. The hearings will be open to the public via live stream. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Mitchell Murphy with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. The County of San Diego's SD Emergency app is now equipped with Shake Ready SD and Earthquake Early Warning System. County Board of Supervisors Chairman Nathan Fletcher says this is an early warning system that has the potential to give users a few seconds warning or a heads up that an earthquake is coming. And that advance warning could make all the difference. It could give you a number of seconds to be able to move your family, your friends, into a safe place and help avoid serious injury. The system relies on a network of over 770 underground sensors and other technologies created in partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey. The Shake Ready SD technology is designed to trigger an alert to your cell phone if you are in a location close enough to an earthquake with a magnitude of 4.5 or greater with a shaking intensity of 3 or greater. Following the alert, the app could provide emergency notifications such as road closures, shelters, or other relevant critical information as needed. And since it is tied to the statewide system of sensors, it will work anywhere in the state to alert people of imminent shaking. Shake Ready SD can save lives and reduce injuries by giving people time to take a protective action like dropping cover and hold on or move away from hazardous areas, says Robert Michael DeGroote with U.S. Geological Survey. For the new feature to work, users who already have the SD Emergency app will need to update it and then configure the settings to allow the app to always track the phone's location so it can accurately alert you if an earthquake with moderate to strong shaking is expected in the area. The app is available in English or Spanish.
Two orphaned bear cubs are now being cared for at the San Diego Humane Society's Ramona Wildlife Center. The young bears, estimated to be around 6 months of age, were brought to the Humane Society's Project Wildlife team by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife on August 18th. The bears had been seen without their mother, getting too close to humans in the Three Rivers area in Tulare, California, even being fed by people in the neighborhoods. For their own safety and the safety of the public, state wildlife officials captured the cubs. Christine Barton, Director of Operations and Wildlife Rehab at San Diego Humane Society's Ramona campus, says these two cubs are definitely too young to survive on their own without their mother. She voiced gratitude that state wildlife officials were able to capture and rescue the cubs, noting that bear encounters with humans often don't end well. While at the Ramona Wildlife Center, the Project Wildlife team will provide a safe environment where the bear cubs can thrive, grow, and eventually be released back into the wild where they belong. San Diego Humane Society's Project Wildlife program is the primary resource for wild animal rehabilitation and conservation education in San Diego County. Each year, the Humane Society gives almost 13,000 injured, orphaned, and sick wild animals a second chance. In 2020, last year, the local Humane Society announced a new Ramona campus, where they now specialize in caring for native apex predators and birds of prey, including hawks, owls, eagles, coyotes, bears, bobcats, and, under a new pilot program, mountain lions. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Ramona, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are still trying to pull out from the depths of the very deep pandemic-driven recession.
Labor Day 2021 comes after a grim August jobs report showing a significant slowdown in hiring, nearly 500,000 fewer jobs than expected. Elise Gold with the Economic Policy Institute also notes almost 8.5 million Americans are currently out of work, not even considering those who have dropped down to the labor force or are working less than they want.
Put all this together, we're talking about almost 19 million workers that are being hurt right now.
In all, employment is down by about 5.5 million compared to the start of the pandemic. And many of those who are working still face the risk of getting COVID-19 on the job and some struggle with telecommuting or virtual learning. Adding to those challenges, federal emergency unemployment programs expired today, including the $300 a week in supplemental federal benefits offered in half the states. Conservatives argue those programs compound a labor shortage because people prefer living off benefits instead of finding work. Republican Senator Rob Portman from Ohio.
And if you go down your main street, wherever you live, you'll see the help wanted signs up. If you go by your restaurants, you will see, instead of the marquee saying, come and check out our great apple pie or our hamburgers, they say, we're paying signing bonuses, $500, $250.
Others counter that higher wages are succeeding in bringing in applicants, and unemployment assistance helps people take the time to find better jobs that match their skills. Meanwhile, for those who are working, inequalities persist. President of the AFL-CIO, Liz Schuller, says over the last four decades, productivity has grown 3.5 times as fast as pay for the typical worker.
Workers are still getting the raw deal. The jobs in America have been consistently downgraded. It's a race to the bottom.
At the biggest corporations, average CEO pay rose nearly 20% last year compared to less than 4% for the typical worker. The stock markets are in or near record territory. Tom Perez, Labor Secretary under President Barack Obama, calls income inequality a defining issue of our time.
There's no one magic bullet to address income inequality, but making sure that we can address the right to form a union, that we can grow the union movement, that is a key.
Perez says the Protecting the Right to Organize Act passed by the House would expand collective bargaining rights for workers and reform labor law.
I think that this PRO Act is going to help us to expand union density. And when we expand union density, we expand the middle class. And that's what it's all about, helping people get in and stay in the middle class.
A new Gallup poll finds more than 2/3 of Americans approve of labor unions, the highest rate since 1965. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our A Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
COVID-19 burnout is driving many nurses to quit, and hospital administrators say the state's new vaccine mandate is compounding that shortage, CalMatters reports. Around California and the nation, nurses are trading in high-pressure jobs for a career change, early retirement, or less demanding assignments, leading to staffing shortages in many hospitals. Hospitals are struggling to comply with the state's nurse staffing requirements as pandemic-induced burnout has exacerbated an already chronic nursing shortage nationwide. Some traveling nurses, who are in high demand nationwide, are turning down California assignments because they don't want to get vaccinated. Hospitals say they are reaching a crisis point, straining under the dual forces of more people seeking routine care and surging COVID-19 hospitalizations driven by the Delta variant. Dr. Tom Sugarman, an emergency physician in the East Bay, says there is not enough staff to keep beds open, and patients can languish waiting. Last week, Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order reinstating emergency provisions aimed at ensuring adequate staffing. In part, the order allows healthcare workers from out of state to work in California. Before the pandemic, nursing shortages were already common in most parts of the state, according to the Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development. But now the pandemic has stretched resources to a breaking point. Hospitals, some with more COVID-19 patients now than during the winter surge, say they are confronting unprecedented staffing shortages, especially among nurses. Lois Richardson, an attorney for the California Hospital Association, says all of our hospitals are saying staffing is a big problem. We have fewer personnel than at the beginning of the pandemic and more patients. The staffing shortage is so severe that Scripps Health in San Diego is considering temporarily consolidating some of its outpatient centers. Scripps, which has 5 hospitals and 28 outpatient clinics in the San Diego area, told CalMatters it's serving nearly 20% more patients on average than before the pandemic. At the same time, job openings at the hospitals have increased 57% since August 2019. And for nursing jobs alone, vacancies have increased 96%. Eric Cole, Corporate Senior Vice President of Human Resources for Scripps, says we've had some staff leave the organization or leave the industry as a whole because they're burned out. They'll wake up in the morning and call off the shift. They've done as much as they can do. All of our hospitals are saying staffing is a big problem, he adds. We have fewer personnel than at the beginning of the pandemic and more patients. Emotional and physical exhaustion is the primary reason nurses are fleeing the bedside, experts say. It's been a long and brutal 18 months. Zenay Triunfo-Cortez, president of National Nurses United, the biggest nursing union in the nation, told CalMatters, "We thought the pandemic would be over soon and could take time later to deal with our emotions. Then the second surge hit, and the third, and now it's the fourth." Mary Lynn Briggs, an ICU nurse in Bakersfield, said of the dozens of COVID-19 patients she has treated since the pandemic began, only three have survived. She says, "Some days coming home from the hospital, I yell at God, I yell at myself, I yell at COVID, and cry, and that's all before I pull into my driveway." Now, California is the only state that caps the number of patients that can be assigned to a single nurse. Under state requirements, an ICU nurse can have no more than two patients, and an emergency room nurse no more than four, for instance. In December, during that winter surge, emergency waivers for the ratios were granted to hospitals throughout the state, allowing ICU nurses to see three patients. But critics say the conditions threatened patient safety. And making nurses care for more critically ill patients also increases the pressure and stress on nurses. The state health department did not respond to CalMatters' request asking whether hospitals have applied for new staffing waivers in response to the shortages. Hospital administrators worry that the state's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers, which starts September 30th, could drive some of their workers out. And already, some report resistance among employees. Richardson, the hospital association's attorney, says one hospital told us they had 474 unvaccinated employees. They did a big education and incentive push. Only 12 people signed up. Administrators are especially concerned about low vaccination rates among support staff, like janitors and food service workers. But some nurses also are wary of the COVID-19 vaccine, and some have held protests claiming the vaccine requirement limits their freedom. The vaccine order allows only for narrow religious and medical exemptions, and the State Nursing Association has issued a statement urging all eligible people to be vaccinated. While California was first in the nation to impose a vaccine mandate for healthcare workers, other states have since joined in, although those mandates aren't quite as broad. To contend with local shortages, hospitals are increasingly turning to hiring temporary traveling nurses from around the country. Cole from Scripps Health said the state's testing requirement already has discouraged some out-of-state traveling nurses from taking temporary jobs at California hospitals. But that vaccine mandate is meant to protect vulnerable patients and other staffers at hospitals and their families from contracting COVID-19 from unvaccinated medical workers, posing a real catch-22 for hospitals. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
San Diego County Supervisors held a hearing August 31st on public safety power shutoffs. Chairman Nathan Fletcher emphasized the importance of this timely issue in light of wildfire concerns. Back in March, supervisors asked staff to prepare a report on how to increase regional resiliency and lessen impacts for residents of repeated planned power shutoffs during extreme fire risk conditions. So on May 31st, Jeff Toney, director of the Office of Emergency Services for the county, gave supervisors an overview and proposed mitigation measures. He noted that according to the California Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, utility infrastructure historically has been responsible for less than 10% of reported wildfires in the state, and yet comprised about half of the most destructive wildfires in California history. That includes the 2007 firestorms that devastated San Diego County. Hoping to reduce fires caused by utilities, in 2012, the PUC voted to allow utilities to impose public safety power shutoffs during hot, windy conditions. SDG&E began using shutoffs in 2013, and since then, other utilities across the state have done so too. After many residents and businesses, however, complained about negative impacts and even dangerous conditions caused by the shutoffs, Governor Gavin Newsom in 2019 launched a program for local governments to help mitigate the impacts of the power shutoffs, granting $1.8 million to our county in 2018 and 2019. San Diego County has used that money to invest in things like backup generators at six county fire stations and at the Potrero and Descanso libraries, remote areas subject to frequent shutoffs. It's also funded helping keep power on for the sheriff's headquarters and the public health laboratory, as well as battery backup replacement for 54 traffic signals, but that's only about a quarter of the signals in East County. The county's Office of Emergency Services has formed a public safety power shutoff working group with diverse stakeholders to work with SDG&E, governmental and tribal agencies, and other groups across our region. They created a public survey, and it drew over 2,300 heated responses. The survey in five languages asked residents about notifications for power shutoffs, their personal preparedness, and an open-ended question about their experiences. You can still take that survey at readysandiego.gov. Common issues for residents include food spoilage, lack of clarity on SDG&E's claims process, lack of lighting and air conditioning during outages, inability to charge electric vehicles or to work remotely, loss of power to well pumps, insufficient battery backup for durable medical equipment, which is life-saving, solar panel limits with no battery backup, and inadequate notice when outages end. Recommendations of the working group include having the county encourage residents to pursue rebates for generators and renewable power options, review and improve the plan check and permit process to improve undergrounding of utilities, work to educate the public on generator usage, engage trained volunteer organizations such as Community Emergency Response or CERT teams or the Sheriff's You Are Not Alone program to assist with welfare checks for residents with special needs or to volunteer at a community resource center. Work to expand outreach and warnings of outages, including to underserved communities, and to promote calling 211 for those who need help. Research options to strengthen and maintain VHF radio coverage and maintenance for first responders, and install backup power for key infrastructure and county facilities. And advocate for the state to reimburse the county for more costs, as well as look to state grants, FEMA, county grant programs, the American Rescue Plan Act, or private donations for additional mitigation funding. A staffer said that the county recognizes that long-term and frequent power outages are challenges for many residents, but said they are not going away anytime soon due to extreme weather. Vanessa Garcia, SDG&E's public affairs spokesperson, said the company is proud of our wildfire efforts to help the utility prevent its equipment from causing more fires. She said the company is working to limit the duration and frequency of outages, as well as innovative ideas such as building community microgrids, perhaps, selective undergrounding of power lines, and piloting mobile power stations with charging ports for clean energy vehicles and to keep power on for customers when the lights go out. East County's two supervisors each offered amendments. Supervisor Jim Desmond noted that the initial survey revealed a great deal of what the public thought. 73% felt that they did not have sufficient resources to maintain safety of life, health, and environment, such as getting well water out. 72% said they were not sufficiently notified when the power shutoff event ended. Desmond praised SDG&E for working to pinpoint communities at risk and be a leader statewide on these issues, but he added, "We still have some more work to do." Desmond voiced concern about traffic safety at intersections, especially at night. He related that a fire chief told him of seeing everything from semis to horse trailers driving through intersections without stopping when lights were out, narrowly missing vehicles. The chief said he was advised by the California Highway Patrol and Caltrans that they had no plans to help with traffic control during the outages, Desmond said. And he noted that the county's unincorporated areas have 202 traffic lights, but battery backups only last about 6 to 8 hours, and they switched to flashing red lights after just 4 hours. He recommended accepting the staff report, but adding an amendment for staff to ID an agency responsible for placing traffic control devices along evacuation corridors and making sure that battery backup generators last for days, not just hours. Supervisor Anderson seconded that motion and proposed one of his own. He asked that staff look to implement $8 million in credits for undergrounding utility lines as soon as possible. Anderson said, "Where we have the most impacts due to wind influences, we should underground those lines." He also asked that the county push the PUC to increase funding for a community power resilience program back to at least the pre-COVID level of $1.2 million. The proposed reforms, including the amendments by Desmond and Anderson, passed unanimously 5-0. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Shalais Hassan with a special report on wildfire preparedness from KNSJ's East County Magazine radio show. Now is the time to prepare for what is shaping up as a tougher-than-usual fire season. The firestorms of 2003 and 2007 taught us that homes with defensible space are far more likely to survive than homes without it. Defensible space is an area around the home where plants and trees are maintained to prevent fire from spreading quickly. A buffer zone gives firefighters a better chance to make a stand and save your home during a wildfire. Fire officials recommend clearing away dry brush to form a 100-foot buffer zone around your home. The buffer could include hardscaping such as tile, stone, or concrete patios and walkways, or fire-resistant landscaping such as succulents. Trim tree branches 6 feet above the ground so that low-hanging branches won't become ladders to spread of wildfire. Be sure to have a family evacuation plan in place and assemble a 72-hour survival kit. You can download it at readysandiego.org. Sign up
for East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts
at www.eastcountymagazine.org, where you can find timely news stories posted live during emergencies. In addition, you can also register with Alert San Diego, the region's reverse 911 system, at readysandiego.org. During an emergency, you can also consult sdcountyemergency.com, the county's website with evacuation updates and maps.
And next up, we're going to have one of our Best of East County favorites, an oldie but goodie, our interview with Lakeside's Rodeo Clown.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital.
I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh. That's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple of things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that one. Puts you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said, early on, is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players, but it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer, so you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your?
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot. Give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get to break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. And you have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school. And the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern-day rodeo, we have schools And the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah. What's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay. The barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena. Actually, not quite the middle, it's a little closer to the bucking shoes. And it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land. They can come there, catch their breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously, on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's gonna do what he wants to do. He's going to do this. So you're going to be put in a position where you're going to get in there that you're probably going to get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody?
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red, like don't like red capes? Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. That's it doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors, you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow the cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.